much he missed her. Then the phone erupted and startled him. It was Pat and French in the lobby with a limo waiting. Dinner and wine for the next 3 hours. Someone had to do it. All participants had been sworn to secrecy. Thick documents had been signed by the lawyers promising complete confidentiality concerning the Dyloff negotiations and settlement. Before they left New York, Pat and French had told his group, "It'll be in the papers within 48 hours. Fala will leak it, and their stock will go up." The following morning, the Wall Street Journal ran the story. Of course, all blame was laid at the bar. "Mass tort lawyers force quick Dyloff settlement," ran the headline. Unnamed sources had plenty to say. The details were accurate. A pool of $2.5 billion would be set up for the first round of settlements, with another potential $1.5 billion as a reserve for more serious cases. Philo Products opened at $82 and quickly jumped to $85. One analyst said investors were relieved at news of the settlement. The company would be able to control the costs of litigation. No prolonged lawsuits. No threat of wild verdicts. The trial lawyers had been reined in on this one, and unnamed sources at Philo were calling it a victory. Clay monitored the news on the television in his office. He also fielded calls from reporters. At 11, one from the Journal arrived with a photographer. During the preliminaries, Clay learned that he knew as much about the settlement as Clay himself. "These things are never kept quiet," he said. "We knew which hotel you guys were hiding in." Off the record, Clay answered all questions. Then on the record, he wouldn't comment on the settlement. He did offer some insights about himself, his rapid rise from the depths of OPD to mass tort zillionaire, all in just a few months, and the impressive firm he was building, etc. He could see the story taking shape, and it would be spectacular. Next morning, he read it online before sunrise. There was his face, in one of those hideous sketches made famous by the Journal, and just above it was the headline, "The King of Torts, from $40,000 to $100 million in 6 months." Under it was a subtitle, "You Gotta Love the Law." He read it twice, then emailed it to Rebecca, with a note at the top and bottom. "Rebecca, please wait. Clay." He sent it to her apartment and her office, and while he was at it, he removed his own message and faxed it to the offices of BVH Group. The wedding was a month away. When he finally arrived at the office, Miss Glick handed him a stack of messages, about half from law school friends who jokingly asked for loans, about half from journalists of all varieties. The office was even more chaotic than normal. Paulette, Jonah, and Rodney were still floating and completely unfocused. Every client wanted the money that day. Fortunately, it was the Yale branch, under the emerging brilliance of Mr. Oscar Mulrooney, that stepped up to the task and put together a plan to survive until the settlement. Clay moved Mulrooney into an office down the hall, doubled his salary, and left him in charge of the mess. Clay needed a break. Because Jarrett Carter's passport had been quietly confiscated by the U.S. Department of Justice, his movements were somewhat limited. "We'd better stick to the Bahamas," he told Clay on the phone. They left Abaco on a Cessna Citation V, another toy Clay had discovered. They were headed for Nassau, 30 minutes away. Jarrett waited until they were airborne before saying, "Okay, spill your guts." He was already gulping a beer, and he was wearing frayed denim shorts and sandals and an old fishing cap, very much the expatriate banished to the islands and living the life of a pirate. Clay opened a beer himself, then began with Tarvan and ended with Dyloft. Jarrett had heard rumors of his son's success, but he never read newspapers and tried his best to ignore any news from home. Another beer as he tried to digest the idea of having 5,000 clients at once. The $100 million closed his eyes, turned him pale, or at least a slightly lighter shade of bronze, and it creased his leathery forehead with a wave of thick wrinkles. He shook his head, drank some beer, then began laughing. In Nassau, they looked at boats. The one they chose was a 63-foot catamaran made by a builder of fine sailboats in Fort Lauderdale. Supposedly, it could sleep 8, plus a crew of 2. Tight quarters, but then everything was junior-sized. The shower was too small to turn around in. According to Jarrett, it was impossible to make money catching fish. The real money was in private sailboat charters for small groups of wealthy people who wanted to work, not be pampered. Semi-serious sailors. Take a great boat, your own boat, preferably one without liens on it, and sail around the Caribbean for a month at a time. The cost to Clay was $2.9 million. The boat was a gift from son to father, an asset to be hidden away in the islands, much like Jared himself. Over dinner their last night in Nassau, in the back of a seedy saloon packed with drug dealers and tax cheaters and alimony dodgers, virtually all of them American, Clay cracked crab legs and finally asked a question he'd been considering for weeks now. Any chance you could ever return to the States? For what? To practice law, to be my partner, to litigate and kick ass again? The question made Jarrett smile. The thought of father and son working together, the very idea that Clay wanted him to return. I doubt it, Clay. I surrendered my license and promised to stay away. Would you want to come back? Maybe to clear my name, but never to practice law again. There's too much baggage, too many old enemies still lurking around. I'm 55 years old, and that's a bit late to start over. Where will you be in 10 years? I don't think like that. I don't believe in calendars and schedules and lists of things to do. Live for the moment, Clay. Tomorrow will take care of itself. You've got your hands full right now, seems to me. When Mr. Ted Worley of Upper Marlboro, Maryland, received a thick envelope from the law offices of J. Clay Carter II, he immediately opened it. He'd seen various news reports about the Dyloft settlement. He'd watched the Dyloft website religiously, waiting for some sign that it was time to collect his money from Ackerman Labs. The letter began, "Dear Mr. Worley, congratulations. Your class action claim against Ackerman Labs has been settled in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Mississippi. As a Group 1 plaintiff, your portion of the settlement is $62,000. Pursuant to the contract for legal services entered into by you and this law firm, a 28% contingency for attorney's fees is now applicable. In addition, a deduction of $1,400 for litigation expenses has been approved by the court. Your net settlement is $43,240. Please sign the enclosed agreement and acknowledgement forms and return them immediately in the enclosed envelope. Sincerely, Oscar Mulrooney, Attorney at Law." Mr. Worley called Mr. Mulrooney 6 times and left 6 hot messages and waited 6 hours until Mr. Mulrooney called him back. "Who the hell are you?" Mr. Worley began pleasantly. Oscar Mulrooney in the past 10 days had become an expert at handling such calls. He explained that he was the attorney in charge of Mr. Worley's case. "This settlement is a joke," Mr. Worley said. $43,000 is criminal. I'm not accepting it." "I'm afraid you have no choice, Mr. Worley." "The hell I don't." "Look at the contract for legal services, Mr. Worley. It's page 11 in the packet you have there. Paragraph 8 is called the pre-authorization. Read the language, sir, and you'll see that you authorize this firm to settle for anything above $50,000 before lawyer's fees." "I remember that, but it was described to me as a starting point. I was expecting much more." "Your settlement has already been approved by the court, sir. That's the way class actions work. If you don't sign the acceptance form, then your portion will stay in the pot and eventually go to someone else." "You're a bunch of crooks, you know that? I don't know who's worse, the company that made the drug or my own lawyers who are screwing me out of a fair settlement." "Sorry you feel that way." "You're not sorry about a damn thing. Paper says you're getting $100 million. Thieves!" Mr. Worley slammed the phone down and flung the papers across his kitchen. Jonah had already announced that retirement was a real possibility. He'd spent 10 days on Antigua with not one girl, but 2. And when he returned to D.C. in an early December snowstorm, he confided in Clay that he was mentally and psychologically unfit to practice law any longer. He'd had all he could take. His legal career was over. "I need a bimbo, preferably a blonde," Clay said as he settled into a chair across from Jonah's desk. His door was locked. It was after 6 on a Wednesday, and Jonah had a bottle of beer opened. "The hottest bachelor in town is having trouble picking up chicks?" "I've been out of the loop. I'm going to Rebecca's wedding, and I need a babe who'll steal the show." "Oh, this is beautiful," he said as he laughed and reached into a drawer in his desk. Only Jonah would keep files on women. He burrowed through some paperwork and found what he wanted. He tossed a folded newspaper across the desk. It was a lingerie ad for a department store. The gorgeous young goddess was wearing practically nothing below the waist and was barely covering her breasts with her folded arms. Clay vividly remembered seeing the ad the morning it first ran. The date was 4 months earlier.
You know her?
Of course I know her. You think I keep lingerie ads just for the thrills? Wouldn't surprise me. Her name is Ridley. At least that's what she goes by. She lives here? Clay was still gawking at the stunning beauty he was holding in black and white. She's from Georgia.
Oh, a southern girl.
No, a Russian girl, the country of Georgia. She came over as an exchange student and never left.
She looks 18.
Mid-20s.
How tall is she?
5'10 or so.
In an effort to appear somewhat nonchalant, Clay tossed the paper back on the desk.
Any downside?
Yes, she's rumored to be a switch hitter.
A what? She likes boys and girls.
Ouch.
No confirmation, but a lot of models go both ways. Could be just a rumor for all I know.
You've dated her?
Nope. Friend of a friend. She's on my list. I was just waiting for a confirmation. Give it a try. You don't like her, we'll find another bimbo.
Can you make the call?
Sure, no problem. It's an easy call. Now that you're Mr. Coverboy, most eligible bachelor, the king of torts. Wonder if they know what torts are over in Georgia. Not if they're lucky. Just make the call.
They met for dinner at the restaurant of the month, a Japanese place frequented by the young and prosperous. With aqua eyes and high cheekbones, Ridley looked even better in person than she did in print. Heads jerked and necks twisted as they were led to the center of the restaurant and placed at a very powerful table. Waiters swarmed around them. Their slightly accented English was perfect, and just exotic enough to add even more sex to the package, as if she needed it. Her real name was Radal Potashnikov, which he had to spell twice before Clay got it. Fortunately, models, like soccer players, could survive with only one name, so she went just by Ridley. She had the looks, and he had the money. And since they could talk about neither, they threshed about in deep water for a few minutes looking for safe ground. She was Georgian, not Russian, and cared nothing about politics or terrorism or football. Ah, the movies. She saw everything and loved them all, even dreadful stuff that no one else went to see. Box office disasters were much beloved by Ridley, and Clay was beginning to have doubts. He knocked back the wine and got himself loosened up. It was a red burgundy. Patton French would have been proud. If only his masked tort buddies could see him now sitting across from this Barbie doll. The only negative was the nasty rumor. Surely she couldn't go for women. She was too perfect, too exquisite, too appealing to the opposite sex. But there was something about her that kept him suspicious. Once the initial shock of her looks wore off, and that took at least 2 hours and one bottle of wine, Clay realized he wasn't getting past the surface. Either there wasn't much depth, or it was carefully protected. Over dessert, a chocolate mousse that she toyed with but did not eat, he invited her to attend a wedding reception. He confessed that the bride was his former fiancé, but lied when he said that they were now on friendly terms. Ridley shrugged as if she preferred to go to the movies.
"Why not?" she said.
As he turned into the drive of the Potomac Country Club, Clay was hit hard by the moment. His last visit to this wretched place had been more than 7 months earlier, a torturous dinner with Rebecca's parents. Then he'd hidden his old Honda behind the tennis courts. Now he was showing off a freshly detailed Porsche Carrera. Then he'd avoided the valet parking to save money. Now he'd tipped the kid extra. Then he was alone and dreading the next few hours with the Van Horns. Now he was escorting the priceless Ridley, who held his elbow and crossed her legs in such a way that the slit in her skirt showed all the way to her waist.
"Van Horn wedding reception," he said to the guard, who waved him through. They were an hour late, which was perfect timing. The ballroom was packed, and a rhythm and blues band played at one end.
"Stay close to me," Ridley whispered as they entered. "I won't know anyone here."
"Don't worry," Clay said. Staying close would not be a problem. And though he pretended otherwise, he wouldn't know anyone either.
Heads began turning immediately. Jaws dropped. All the boys wanted to say hello. But a minute later an announcement was being made on stage and the room became quieter. The bride and groom were about to dance, to be followed by the bride and her father, then the groom and his mother, and so on. The crowd gathered around to watch. The band began playing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
"She's very pretty," Ridley whispered, very close to his right ear. Indeed she was. And she was dancing with Jason Myers, who, though he was 2 inches shorter, appeared to Rebecca to be the only person in the world. She smiled and glowed as they spun slowly around the dance floor, the bride doing most of the work because her groom was as stiff as a board. Clay wanted to attack, to bolt through the crowd and sucker-punch Myers with all the force he could muster. He would rescue his girl and take her away and shoot her mother if she found them.
"You still love her, don't you?" Ridley was whispering.
"No,
it's over," he whispered back.
"You do, I can tell."
"No." The two were painful to watch, and Clay asked himself why he was there. Closure, whatever that meant. A farewell. But he wanted Rebecca to see him and Ridley, and to know that he was faring well and not missing her. Watching Bennett the Bulldozer dance was painful for other reasons. He subscribed to the white man's theory of dancing without moving his feet. And when he tried to shake his butt, the band actually laughed. His cheeks were already crimson from too much chivas. Jason Myers danced with Barbara Van Horn, who was poured into a dress that, while pretty, was several sizes too small. She had plastered across her face the phoniest grin she'd ever produced.
"Would you like to dance?" someone asked Ridley.
"Bug off," Clay said, then led her to the dance floor where a mob was gyrating to some pretty good Motown. If Ridley standing still was a work of art, Ridley in full motion was a national treasure. She moved with a natural rhythm and easy grace, with the low-cut dress just barely high enough and the slit in the skirt flying open to reveal all manner of flesh. Groups of men were gathering to watch. And watching also was Rebecca. Taking a break to chat with her guests, she noticed the commotion and looked into the crowd where she saw Clay dancing with a knockout. She too was stunned by Ridley, but for other reasons. She continued chatting for a moment, then moved back to the dance floor. Meanwhile, Clay's eyes were working furiously to check on Rebecca without missing a movement from Ridley. The song ended, a slow number began, and Rebecca stepped between them.
"Hello, Clay," she said, ignoring his date. "How about a dance?"
"Sure," he said. Ridley shrugged and moved away, alone for only a second before a stampede surrounded her. She picked the tallest one, threw her arms around him, and began pulsating.
"Don't remember inviting you," Rebecca said with an arm over his shoulder.
"You want me to leave?" He pulled her slightly closer, but the bulky wedding dress prevented the contact he wanted.
"People are watching," she said, smiling for their benefit. "Why are you here?"
"To celebrate your wedding, and to get a good look at your new boy."
"Don't be ugly, Clay. You're just jealous."
"I'm more than jealous. I'd like to break his neck."
"Where'd you get the bimbo?"
"Now who's jealous?"
"Me."
"Don't worry, Rebecca. She can't touch you in bed." On second thought, perhaps she'd like to. Anyway.
"Jason's not bad."
"I really don't want to hear about it. Just don't get pregnant, okay?"
"That's hardly any of your business."
"It's very much my business. Just hang in there for a year, okay?" he said. "By then I'll have 200 million. We can hop on my jet, blow this joint, spend the rest of our lives on a yacht. Your parents will never find us." She stopped moving and said, "Goodbye, Clay."
"I'll wait," he said, then got knocked aside by a stumbling Bennett.
Barbara was next. She took Clay's hand and flashed an artificial smile.
"Let's not make a scene," she said without moving her lips.
They began a rigid movement that no one would mistake for dancing.
"And how are you, Mrs. Van Horn?" Clay said in the clutches of a pit viper. "Fine, until I saw you. I'm positive you were not invited to this little party."
"I was just leaving."
"Good. I'd hate to call security."
"That won't be necessary."
"Don't ruin this moment for her, please."
"Like I said, I was just leaving." The music stopped and Clay jerked away from Mrs. Van Horn. A small mob materialized around Ridley, but Clay whisked her off. They retreated to the back of the room where a bar was attracting more fans than the band. Clay grabbed a beer and was planning an exit when another group of onlookers encircled them. Lawyers in the bunch wanted to talk about the joys of mass torts while pressing close to Ridley. After a few minutes of idiotic small talk with people he detested, a thick young man in a rented tuxedo appeared next to Clay and whispered,
"I'm security.
He had a friendly face and seemed very professional.
"I'm leaving," Clay whispered back.
Tossed from the Van Horde wedding reception, ejected from the Great Potomac Country Club, driving away, with Ridley wrapped around him, he privately declared it to be one of his finest moments. The announcement had said the newlyweds would honeymoon in Mexico. Clay decided to take a trip himself. If anyone deserved a month on an island, it was he. His once formidable team had lost all direction. Perhaps it was the holidays, perhaps it was the money. Whatever the reason, Jonah, Paulette, and Rodney were spending fewer hours at the office. As was Clay. The place was filled with tension and strife. So many Dyloft clients were unhappy with their meager settlements. The mail was brutal. Dodging the phone had become a sport. Several clients had actually found the place and presented themselves to Miss Glick with demands to see Mr. Carter, who, it happened, was always in a big trial somewhere. Usually he was hunkering down in his office with the door locked, riding out yet another storm. After one particularly troubling day, he called Patton French for advice.
"Toughen up, old boy," French said. "It goes with the territory. You are making a fortune in mass torts. This is just the downside. It takes a thick skin."
The thickest skin in the firm belonged to Oscar Mulrooney, who continued to amaze Clay with his organizational skills and his ambition. Mulrooney was working 15 hours a day and pushing his Yale branch to collect the Dyloft money as quickly as possible. He readily assumed any unpleasant task. With Jonah making no secret of his plans to sail around the world, Paulette dropping hints about a year in Africa to study art, and Rodney following along with some vague chatter about just plain quitting, it was obvious that there would soon be room at the top. For Christmas, he and Ridley went to the exclusive Caribbean island of Moustique. No hotels, no condos, no tourists, no traffic. The house he had rented was on the side of a mountain, as the brochure described it, though it was just a hill. The view was breathtaking. 200 feet above the water and miles of endless ocean. No other island could be seen. No boats out there, no people. 2 days after Christmas, Max Pace arrived with a companion. Her name was Valeria, a rugged, crunchy outdoors type with broad shoulders and no makeup and a very reluctant smile. Max was a very handsome fellow, but there was nothing attractive about his friend. When Clay shook her hand, he felt calluses. Well, at least she wouldn't be a temptation for Ridley. Because Pace had no background, there was little to talk about, at first anyway. However, it soon became apparent that he had something important on his mind. "Let's talk business," he said after a nap in the sun. They moved to the bar and the butler brought drinks. "There's another drug out there," Pace began, and Clay immediately began seeing money. "And it's a big one. Here we go again. But the plan is a little different this time. I want a piece of the action."
"Who are you working for?" Clay asked.
"Me. And you. I get 25% of the gross attorney's fees."
"What's the upside?"
"It could be bigger than Dyloft."
"Then you get 25%. More if you want."
The two shared so much dirty laundry, how could Clay say no? 25 is fair, Max said, and reached across for a handshake. The deal was done.
"Let's have it," Clay said.
"There's a female hormone drug called Maxitil, used by at least 4 million menopausal and postmenopausal women, ages 45 to 75. It came out 5 years ago, another wonder drug. It relieves hot flashes and other symptoms of menopause, very effective. It's also touted to preserve bone strength, reduce hypertension, and the risks of heart disease. The company is Goffman."
"Goffman? Razor blades and mouthwash?"
"You got it. $21 billion in sales last year. The bluest of all blue chips. Very little debt, sound management. An American tradition. But they got in a hurry with Maxitil. Typical story. Profits looked huge. Drug looked safe. They rammed it through the FDA, and for the first few years, everybody was happy. Doctors loved it. The women are crazy about it because it works beautifully. But? But there are problems. Huge problems. A government study has been tracking 20,000 women who've been taking the drug for 4 years. The study's just been completed, and a report is due in a few weeks. It will be devastating. For a percentage of women, the drug greatly increases the risk of breast cancer, heart attacks, and strokes."
"What percentage?"
"About 8%.
Who knows about the report?"
Very few people. I have a copy of it.
Why am I not surprised?
Clay took a long pull on the bottle and looked around for the butler.
His pulse was racing. He was suddenly bored with Mustique.
There are some lawyers on the prowl, but they haven't seen the government report, Pace continued. One lawsuit has been filed in Arizona, but it's not a class action.
What is it?
Just an old-fashioned tort case, a one-shot deal.
How boring.
Not really. The lawyer is a character named Dale Mooneyham from Tucson. He tries them one at a time, and he never loses.
He's on the fast track to get the first shot at Goffman. It could set the tone for the entire settlement. The key is to file the first class action. You learned that from Patton French.
We can file first, Clay said, as if he'd been doing it for years.
And you can do it alone, without French and those crooks. File it in D.C., then blitz with ads. It'll be huge.
Clay nodded.
Just like Dyloft.
Except you're in charge, Pace insisted.
I'll be in the background, pulling strings, doing the dirty work. I have lots of contacts with all the right shady characters. It'll be our lawsuit, and with your name on it, Goffman will run for cover.
A quick settlement?
Probably not as quick as Dyloft, but then that was remarkably fast.
By the way, I'd like an advance of $1 million against my fee.
Pace took a sip.
I'm still cleaning up some old business back home.
The fact that Pace wanted money struck Clay as odd. However, with so much at stake and with their Tarvan secret, he was in no position to say no.
Approved, he said.
Pace and Valeria stayed for 2 days, which was at least one day too long. Clay and Ridley watched them leave.
Any more guests? Ridley asked warily.
Hell no, Clay said.
Good.
The entire floor above his firm became vacant at the end of the year. Clay leased half of it and consolidated his operations. He brought in the 12 paralegals and 5 secretaries from the sweatshop. The Yale branch lawyers who'd been in other space were likewise transferred to Connecticut Avenue, to the land of higher rents, where they felt more at home. He wanted his entire firm under one roof and close at hand, because he planned to work them all until they dropped. He attacked the new year with a ferocious work schedule. In the office by 6 with breakfast, lunch, and sometimes dinner at his desk. He was usually there until 8 or 9 at night, and left little doubt that he expected similar hours from those who wanted to stay. Jonah did not. He was gone by the middle of January. His office cleared and vacated, his farewells quick. The sailboat was waiting.
Don't bother to call. Just wire the money to an account in Aruba.
Oscar Mulrooney was measuring Jonah's office before he got out the door. It was larger and had a better view, which meant nothing to him, but it was closer to Clay's, and that was what mattered. Mulrooney smelled money, serious fees. He missed on Dyloft, but he would not miss again. He and the rest of the Yale boys had been shafted by the corporate law they'd been trained to covet, and now they were determined to make a mint in retribution. And what better way than by outright solicitation and ambulance chasing? Nothing was more offensive to the stuffed shirts and the blue-blood firms. Mass tort litigation was not practicing law. It was a roguish form of entrepreneurship. Paulette divorced her aging Greek playboy and flew to London. She might come back in a few months. She might not.
Sorry, Clay, she said on the phone, but I really don't want to work anymore.
So Mulrooney became the confidant, the unofficial partner with big ambitions. Mulrooney had a plan. Clay's firm could simply ride the coattails of other mass tort lawyers, sort of pick up the pieces, but for huge fees. He used the example of Skinny Benz. The best estimate of the number of potential plaintiffs was around 300,000, with perhaps as many as 100,000 still unidentified and certainly unrepresented. The litigation had been settled. The company was forking over billions. A claimant simply had to register with the class action administrator, prove her medicals, and collect the money.
Like a general moving his troops, Clay assigned 2 lawyers and a paralegal to the Skinny Ben front. This was less than what Mulrooney asked for, but Clay had bigger plans. He laid out the war on Maxitil, a lawsuit that he would direct himself. The government report, still unreleased and evidently stolen by Max Pace, was 140 pages long and filled with damning results. Clay read it twice before he gave it to Mulrooney. Clay also had preliminary reports on the company in Reedsburg, Pennsylvania, that was making defective brick mortar. Wes Salisbury had passed along the secret file he'd mentioned in New York. Masonry cement wasn't as exciting as bladder tumors or blood clots or leaky heart valves, but the money was just as green. They assigned two lawyers and a paralegal to prepare the class action and to go find some plaintiffs. He started looking seriously at planes. The broker showed him a 1998 model G4 SP, special performance, that a Fortune 500 company had recently traded in for a new G5. When Clay saw it sitting majestically on the ramp at Reagan National, his heart leaped and his pulse took off. It was snow white, with a tasteful royal blue striping. Paris in 6 hours, London in 5. $30 million plus two pilots for $200,000 a year, including benefits, training, everything. A reasonable voice said to be cautious, but why wait? And who exactly might he turn to for advice? The only people he knew with experience in such matters were his mass tort buddies, and every one of them would say, "You don't have your own jet yet? Buy it!" And so he bought it. Max Pace had recently taken up residence in the Hay Adams Hotel. Clay stopped by a suite for a late dinner, one delivered by room service. Pace was edgy and anxious to drop the bomb on Goffman. He read the latest revision of the class action lawsuit to be filed in D.C. As always, he made notes in the margins. "What's the plan?" he said, ignoring his food and wine. Clay was not ignoring his. "The ad started 8 in the morning, he said, with a mouthful of veal. "A blitz in 80 markets, coast to coast. The hotline is set up. The website is ready. My little firm is poised. I'll walk over to the courthouse at 10 or so and file it myself." "Your new pals know nothing of it?" "Of course not. Why would I tell them? We're in bed together with Dyloft, but French and those guys are my competitors, too. I shocked them then, I'll shock them now. I can't wait." "This ain't Dyloft," Pace cautioned. "Remember that. You were lucky there because you caught a weak company at a bad moment. Goffman will be much tougher." Pace finally tossed the lawsuit on the dresser and sat down to eat. "But they made a bad drug," Clay was saying. "And you don't go to trial with a bad drug." "Not in a class action. My sources tell me that Goffman might want to litigate the case in Flagstaff since it's a single plaintiff." "The Mooneyham case?" "That's it. If they lose, they'll be softer on the issue of settlement. If they win, then this could be a long fight." "You said Mooneyham doesn't lose." "It's been 20 years or something like that. Juries love him. He wears cowboy hats and suede jackets and red boots and such. A throwback to the days when trial lawyers actually tried their cases. A real piece of work. You should go meet him. It would be worth a trip." "I'll put that on my list." After all, the Gulfstream was just sitting in the hangar, anxious to travel. Clay slept at the office. He had installed a small bedroom and a bath adjacent to the conference room. Mulrooney arrived just after 6, already with 4 cups of coffee under his belt and 100 ideas on his mind. "D-Day?" he asked when he barged into Clay's office.
"D-Day.
Let's kick some ass!" By 7, the place was rocking with associates and paralegals watching the clocks, waiting for the invasion. At 8, they watched the first ads, clapping and cheering as if the money was about to be delivered by overnight courier. Then Clay sent them all to their posts to sit by the phones and begin collecting clients. Within minutes, the calls started. Promptly at 9, as scheduled, copies of the lawsuit were faxed to newspapers and financial cable channels. Clay called his old pal at the Wall Street Journal and leaked the news. He said he might consider an interview in a day or so. Pat and French called during lunch. Clay was eating a sandwich while standing behind his desk and watching the phone messages pile up.
"I hope you know what you're doing," French said suspiciously.
"Gee, I hope so too, Patton. How are you?"
"Swell. We took a long, hard look at Maxitel about 6 months ago, decided to pass. Causation could be a real problem."
Clay dropped his sandwich and tried to breathe. "Patton French saying no to a mass tort?"
"Well, Patton, we see things differently."
He was reaching behind him, groping for his chair. He finally fell into it.
"In fact," French continued, "everybody passed, until you. Salisbury, Didier, Carlos down in Miami. Guy up in Chicago has a bunch of cases, but he hasn't filed them yet. I don't know, maybe you're right. We just didn't see it, that's all."
"Are you in?" Clay asked.
"No. I didn't like it 6 months ago. Don't like it now. Plus, I got too many other irons in the fire. Good luck!
Clay closed and locked his office door. He walked to his window and stood for at least 5 minutes before he felt the cool moisture of his shirt sticking to his back. Then he rubbed his forehead and found rows of sweat. The headline in the Daily Prophet screamed, "A lousy 100 million ain't enough!" And things got worse after that. The story began with a quick paragraph about the frivolous lawsuit filed yesterday in D.C. against Goffman, one of America's finest consumer products companies. Its wonderful drug, Maxitil, had helped countless women through the nightmare of menopause. But now it was under attack by the same sharks that had bankrupted A.H. Robbins, Johns Manville, Owens, Illinois, and practically the entire American asbestos industry. The story hit its stride when it went after the lead shark, a brash young D.C. hotshot named Clay Carter who, according to their sources, had never tried a civil lawsuit before a jury. Unnamed sources within Goffman said the company would defend itself vigorously, that it would not yield to class-action blackmail, and that it would, at the appropriate time, demand to be reimbursed for its attorney's fees and litigation costs due to the outrageous and frivolous nature of the claims. Clay smiled and acted as if he were honored. "A year ago, no one was talking about me," he boasted. "Now they can't get enough." But behind his locked office door, he was uneasy and fretted about the haste with which he had sued Goffman. The fact that his masked tort pals were not piling on was distressing. Pace had disappeared, which was not unusual, but not exactly what Clay needed at the moment. The following morning, the government report on Maxitil was published, and Goffman's stock got hammered again, dropping $10 a share on the news. Clay and Mulrooney spent the afternoon monitoring websites and cable channels, waiting for some response from the company, but there was none. Clay felt vindicated, but ignored. He had so much to say in response to his critics, but no one wanted to listen. His anxiety was relieved by the deluge of phone calls from Maxitil patients. The Gulfstream finally had to escape. 8 days in the hangar, and Clay was itching to travel. He loaded up Ridley and headed west, first to Las Vegas, though no one around the office knew he was stopping there. It was a business trip and a very important one. He had an appointment with the great Dale Mooneyham in Tucson to talk about Maxitil. They spent 2 nights in Vegas, in a hotel with real cheetahs and panthers on display and a fake game preserve outside the front entrance. Clay lost $30,000 playing blackjack, and Ridley spent $25,000 on clothes in the designer boutiques packed around the hotel's atrium. The Gulfstream fled to Tucson. Mott and Mooneyham had converted an old train station downtown into a pleasantly shabby suite of offices. Clay, alone because Ridley was shopping, browsed around the memorabilia-filled lobby, unaware that he had been kept waiting for almost an hour. An assistant finally fetched him and led him down a wide hall lined with spacious offices. Dale Mooneyham was seated behind his desk and only half stood when Clay entered, unannounced and feeling very much like a vagrant. The handshake was cold and obligatory. He was not welcome there, and he was confused by his reception. Mooneyham was at least 70, a big-framed man with a thick chest and large stomach, blue jeans, gaudy red boots, a wrinkled western shirt, and certainly no necktie. He'd been dyeing his gray hair black, but was in need of another treatment because the sides were white, the top dark and slicked back with too much grease. Long, wide face, the puffy eyes of a drinker. "Nice office, really unique," Clay said, trying to thaw things a bit. "Bought it 40 years ago," Mooneyham said, "by $5,000. "Quite a collection of memorabilia out there." "I've done all right, son. I haven't lost a jury trial in 21 years. I suppose I'm due for a loss, at least that's what my opponents keep saying." Clay glanced around and tried to relax in the low, ancient leather chair. The office was at least 5 times as big as his, with the heads of stuffed game covering the walls and watching his every move. There were no phones ringing, no faxes clattering in the distance. There was not a computer in Mooneyham's office. "I guess I'm here to talk about Maxitil," Clay said, sensing that he might be evicted at any moment. Hesitation. No movement except for a casual readjusting of the dark little eyes. "It's a bad drug," he said simply, as if Clay had no idea. I filed suit about 5 months ago up in Flagstaff. We have a fast track here in Arizona, known as the Rocket Docket, so we should have us a trial by early fall. Unlike you, I don't file suit until my case is thoroughly researched and prepared, and I'm ready to go to trial. Do it that way, and the other side never catches up. I've written a book about pre-lawsuit preparation. Still read it all the time. You should, too. Should I just leave now? Clay wanted to ask. What about your client?
I just have one. Class actions are a fraud, at least the way you and your pals handle them. Mass torts are a scam, a consumer ripoff, a lottery driven by greed that will one day harm all of us. Unbridled greed will swing the pendulum to the other side. Reforms will take place and they'll be severe. You boys will be out of business, but you won't care because you'll have the money. The people who'll get harmed are all the future plaintiffs out there, all the little people who won't be able to sue for bad products because you boys have screwed up the law.
I asked about your client.
66-year-old white female, non-smoker, took Maxitil for 4 years. I met her a year ago. We take our time around here, do our homework before we start shooting.
Clay had intended to talk about big things, big ideas, like how many potential Maxitil clients were out there, and what did Mooneyham expect from Goffman, and what types of experts was he planning to use at trial. Instead, he was looking for a quick exit.
You're not expecting a settlement? He asked, managing to sound somewhat engaged.
I don't settle, son. My clients know that up front. I always go to trial.
And with that, he slowly stood, reached out a limp hand, and said,
I have work to do.
Clay hustled from the office, down the hall, through the museum lobby and outside into the fierce desert heat. The Hanna Portland Cement Company was founded in Reedsburg, Pennsylvania in 1946, in time to catch the post-war explosion of new home construction. It immediately became the largest employer in the small town. The Hanna brothers ran it with iron fists, but they were fair to their workers, who were their neighbors as well. When business was good, the workers received generous wages. When things were slow, everybody tightened their belts and got by. Layoffs were rare and used only as a last resort. The workers were content and never unionized. The Hannas plowed their profits back into the plant and equipment and into the community. They built a civic center, a hospital, a theater, and the nicest high school football field in the area. Over the years, there was a temptation or two to sell out, to take serious cash and go play golf, but the Hanna brothers could never be sure that their factory would remain in Reedsburg, so they kept it. After 50 years of sound management, the company employed 4,000 of the 11,000 residents of the town. Marcus Hanna was the current CEO, though he never used that title. He was just the boss, the number one honcho. His father was one of the founders, and Marcus had spent his life at the plant. No less than 8 other Hannas were in management, with several of the next generation out in the factory, sweeping floors and doing the same menial jobs their parents had been expected to do. On the day the lawsuit arrived, Marcus was in a meeting with his first cousin, Joel Hanna, the unofficial in-house lawyer. A process server bullied his way past the receptionist and secretaries up front and presented himself to Marcus and Joel with a thick envelope.
"Are you Marcus Hanna?" the process server demanded.
"I am. Who are you?"
"A process server. Here's your lawsuit."
He handed it over and left. It was an action filed in Howard County, Maryland, seeking unspecified damages for a class of homeowners claiming damages due to defective Portland mortar cement manufactured by Hanna. Joel read it slowly and paraphrased it for Marcus, and when he finished, both men sat for a long time and cursed lawyers in general. It was no surprise that there was trouble in Howard County. A bad batch of their Portland cement had found its way there several years earlier. Through the normal channels, it had been used by various contractors to put bricks on new homes. The complaints were fresh. The company was trying to get a handle on the scope of the problem. Evidently, it took about 3 years for the mortar to weaken, and then the bricks began to fall off. Both Marcus and Joel had been to Howard County and met with their suppliers and the contractors. They had inspected several of the homes. Current thinking put the number of potential claims at 500 and the cost of repairing each unit at about $12,000. The company had product liability insurance that would cover the first $5 million in claims. But the lawsuit purported to include a class of at least 2,000 potential claimants, each seeking $25,000 in actual damages. "That's $50 million," Marcus said. "And the damn lawyer will rake 40% off the top," added Joel. "You can't do that," Marcus said. "They do it every day." On May 1st, Rex Criddle left the accounting firm where he'd worked for 18 years and moved upstairs to become the business manager of JCC. With the offer of a huge increase in salary and benefits, he simply couldn't say no. The law firm was wildly successful, but in the chaos it was growing so fast, its business seemed out of control. Clay gave him broad authority and parked him in an office across the hall from his. While Criddle certainly appreciated his own large salary, he was skeptical of everyone's around him. In his opinion, which he kept to himself for the time being, most of the employees were overpaid. The firm now had 14 lawyers, all making at least $200,000 a year, 21 paralegals at $75,000 each, 26 secretaries at $50,000 each, with the exception of Miss Glick, who earned $60,000. A dozen or so clerks of different varieties, each earning on the average $20,000, and four office gophers at $15,000 each. A total of 77, not including Criddle and Clay. Adding in the cost of benefits, the total annual payroll was $8.4 million and growing almost weekly. Rent was $72,000 a month. Office expenses, computers, phones, utilities, the list was quite long, were running about $40,000 a month. The Gulfstream, which was the biggest waste of all and the one asset Clay could not live without, was costing the firm $300,000 in monthly mortgage payments and another $30,000 for pilots, maintenance, and hangar fees. The day after Criddle moved in, Rodney moved out, though the two events were not related. Rodney was simply cashing in his chips and moving to the suburbs, to a very nice home on a very safe street, with a church on one end, a school on the other, a park around the corner. He planned to become a full-time coach for his four kids. Employment might come later, and it might not. He'd forgotten about law school. With $10 million in the bank, before taxes, he had no real plans, just a determination to be a father and a husband and a miser. He and Clay sneaked away to a deli down the street just hours before he left the office for good and said their goodbyes. They'd worked together for 6 years, five at OPD, the last one at the new firm. "Don't spend it all, Clay," Rodney warned his friend. "I can't. There's too much of it." "Don't be foolish." The truth was, the firm no longer needed someone like Rodney. The Yale boys and the other lawyers were polite and deferential, mainly because of his friendship with Clay, but he was only a paralegal, and Rodney no longer needed the firm. He wanted to hide his money and protect it. He was secretly appalled at the way Clay was blowing through such a fortune. You pay a price for waste. With Jonah on a sailboat and Paulette still hiding in London and apparently not coming home, the original gang was now gone. Sad, but Clay was too busy to be nostalgic. Pat and French had ordered a meeting of the steering committee, a logistical impossibility that took a month to put together. Clay asked why they couldn't do things by phone, fax, email, and through secretaries, but French said they needed a day together, the five of them in the same room. Since the lawsuit had been filed in Biloxi, he wanted them there. Ridley was up for the trip. Her modeling had all but ceased. She spent her time at the gym and put in several hours a day shopping. Clay had no complaints about the gym time. It provided icing for the cake. The shopping concerned him, but she showed remarkable restraint. She could shop for hours and spend a modest amount. A month earlier, after a long weekend in New York, they had returned to D.C. and driven to his townhouse. She spent the night, not for the first time and evidently not for the last. Though nothing was said about her moving in, it just happened. Marriage was never mentioned, though he was buying enough jewelry and clothes for a harem. Neither appeared to be looking for anything permanent. They enjoyed each other's company and companionship, but both kept a roving eye. There were mysteries around her that Clay did not want to solve. She was gorgeous and pleasant and okay in the sack, and she did not seem to be a gold digger. But she had secrets. So did Clay. His biggest secret was that if Rebecca called at the right time, he'd sell everything but the Gulfstream, load her in it, and fly away to Mars.
A limo met them at the airport in Biloxi. It drove them a few miles to a harbor where a speedboat was waiting. Pat and French spent most of his time on his yacht, 10 miles out in the Gulf. He was now between wives. A nasty divorce was raging. The current one wanted half his money and all his hide. Life was much quieter on a boat, as he called the 200-foot luxury yacht. He greeted them in shorts and bare feet. Wes Salisbury and Damon Didier were already there, stiff drinks in hand. Carlos Hernandez from Miami was due at any moment. French gave them a quick tour, during which Clay counted at least 8 people in perfect white sailor's garb, all standing at the ready in case he needed something. The boat had 5 levels, 6 staterooms, cost $20 million, and on and on. Ridley ducked into a bedroom and began shucking clothes. The boys met for drinks on the porch, as French described it, a small wooden deck on the top level. Another powerboat was coming near. It was Hernandez, with not one but 2 young ladies in tow. After they unloaded and French got them settled in, Carlos met the boys on the porch. "Who are the girls?" West asked. "My paralegals," Carlos said. "Just don't make them partners," said French. "What's up with Maxitil?" Carlos asked. "I have 1,000 cases and I'm not sure what to do with them." "You're asking me what to do with your cases?" Clay said. "How many do you have?" French asked. The mood had changed dramatically. Things were serious now. 20,000, Clay said, fudging just a little. Truth was, he didn't know how many cases were in the office. Well, it was a little exaggerating among mass tort boys. "I haven't filed mine," Carlos said. "Proving causation could be a nightmare." Words that Clay had heard enough and did not want to hear again. For almost 4 months, he'd been waiting for another big name to dive into the Maxitil pit. "I still don't like it," French said. "I was talking to Scotty Gaines yesterday in Dallas. He has 2,000 cases, but isn't sure what to do with them either." "It's very difficult to prove causation based solely on a study," Didier said in Clay's direction, almost lecturing. "I don't like it either." "Anything from Goffman?" French asked. Clay, who was ready to jump overboard, took a long pull on a very strong drink and tried to appear as if he had the corporation dead in the crosshairs. "Nothing," he said. "Discovery's just getting started. I think we're all waiting for Mooneyham." "I talked to him yesterday," Salisbury said. They may not like Maxitil, but they were certainly monitoring it. Clay had been a mass tort lawyer long enough to know that the greatest fear of all was missing the big one. "Mooneyham's a blowhard," French said, as if the typical trial lawyer was tight-lipped and one with a big mouth was a disgrace to the profession. "He is," Salisbury countered, "but he's very good. The old guy hasn't lost in 20 years. 21, Clay said. "At least, that's what he told me." "Whatever," Salisbury said, brushing them aside because he had fresh news. "I hear the trial is set for sometime in September. If Mooneyham can connect the dots and prove causation and liability, then there's a good chance the company will set up a national compensation plan. But if the jury goes with Goffman, then the war is on because the company ain't paying a dime to anybody." "Goffman's a tough bunch," Didier said. "I sued them 15 years ago. If you can prove liability, they'll pay a fair settlement, but if you can't, you're screwed." Clay felt like going for a swim. Fortunately, Maxitil was instantly forgotten when the 2 Cuban paralegals pranced onto the deck below in very skimpy outfits. "Paralegal's my ass," French said, straining for a better view. "Which one is yours?" Salisbury asked, leaning out of his chair. "Take your pick, boys," Carlos said. "They're professionals. I brought them as a gift. We'll pass them around." A storm arrived just before dawn and disrupted the quietness of the yacht. French, badly hungover and with a naked paralegal under his sheets, called the captain from his bed and ordered him to head for shore. Breakfast was postponed, not that anyone was hungry. Dinner had been a 4-hour marathon, complete with courtroom war stories, dirty jokes, and the obligatory late-night bickering caused by too much alcohol. Clay and Ridley had retired early and double-latched their door. Moored in Biloxi Harbor, riding out the storm, the steering committee managed to review all the documents and memos it was supposed to review. There were directions to the class-action administrator and dozens of signature blanks to be filled in. Clay was nauseous by the time they finished, and desperate to stand on solid ground.
They had the villa in St. Bart's for a week,
though Clay doubted he could stay away from the office that long. It was wedged into the side of a hill, overlooking the busy harbor town of Gustavia, a place bustling with traffic and tourists and all kinds of boats coming and going. Ridley had found it in a catalog of exclusive private rentals. It was a fine home, traditional Caribbean architecture, red-tiled roof, long porches and verandas. There were bedrooms and bathrooms too numerous to find, and a chef, two maids, and a gardener. After 3 days, Clay removed his watch and began sleeping in a hammock on a porch. Ridley read books and watched old movies for long stretches of time. Boredom was creeping in when Jarrett Carter sailed into Gustavia Harbor aboard his magnificent catamaran, the Ex-Litigator. Clay was sitting at a bar near the dock, drinking a soda, waiting for his father. His crew consisted of a 40-ish German woman with legs as long as Ridley's, and a roguish old Scotsman named Mackenzie, his sailing instructor. Clay loaded them into his jeep and drove them to his villa, where they showered forever and had drinks while the sun disappeared into the sea. The sailing business had been slow. The Ex-Litigator had been booked 4 times in 6 months. Its longest voyage had been from Nassau to Aruba and back, 3 weeks that generated $30,000 from a retired British couple. The shortest had been a jaunt to Jamaica, where they'd almost lost the boat in a storm. Long after dinner, and after the others had retired for the night, Jarrett and Clay moved to another porch for another round of drinks. "Where'd you find her?" Jarrett asked, and Clay gave a quick history of Ridley. On the legal front, Jarrett had 100 questions. He was alarmed at the size of Clay's new firm and felt compelled to offer unsolicited advice on how to run things. "You don't understand mass torts," Clay finally told him.
"Sounds like mass exposure to me," Jarrett countered. "What's your malpractice limit?"
$10 million.
"That's not enough."
"That's all the insurance company would sell me. Relax, Dad. I know what I'm doing." It was quiet for a long time. Both men needed sleep. Jarrett stood and walked to the edge of the porch.
"You ever think about that black kid?" he asked, staring into the night.
"The one who started shooting and had no idea why?"
"Tequila?"
"Yeah, you told me about him in Nassau when we were buying the sailboat."
"Yeah, I think about him occasionally."
"Good. Money isn't everything." And with that, Jarrett went to bed. 2 nights on land and Jarrett was ready for the sea. They said goodbye early the second morning, and his father's catamaran motored out of Gustavia Harbor, headed nowhere in particular. Clay could hear his father and Mackenzie bickering about something as they headed for open water. He was never certain how the realtor materialized on the porch of the villa. She was there when he returned, a charming French woman chatting with Ridley and having a coffee. She said she was in the neighborhood, just stopped by to check on the house, which was owned by one of their clients, a Canadian couple in the midst of a nasty divorce, and how were things?
"Couldn't be better," Clay said, taking a seat. "Great house."
"Isn't it wonderful?" the realtor gushed. "One of our finest properties. I was just telling Ridley that it was built only 4 years ago by these Canadians who've been down twice, I think. His business turned bad. She started seeing her doctor, a real mess up there in Ottawa, and so they've put it on the market at a very reasonable price."
A conspiratorial glance from Ridley. Clay asked the question left hanging in the air.
"How much?"
"Only $3 million. Started at 5, but frankly, the market is a bit soft right now."
After she left, Ridley attacked him in the bedroom. Morning sex was unheard of, but they had an impressive go at it. Same for the afternoon. Dinner in a fine restaurant. She couldn't keep her hands off him. The midnight session began in the pool, went to the jacuzzi, then to the bedroom, and after an all-nighter, the realtor was back before lunch. Clay was exhausted and really not in the mood for more property. But Ridley wanted the house much more than she had wanted anything so far, so he bought it. The price was actually on the low end. It was a bargain. The market would tighten up, and he could always sell it for a profit. During the paperwork, Ridley asked Clay privately if it might be wise to put the house in her name, for tax reasons. "Hell no," he said to himself, but to her he said firmly, "No, that won't work for tax reasons." She appeared to be wounded, but the pain passed quickly as he assumed ownership. Clay went to a bank in Gustavia alone, wired the money from an offshore account. When he met with the property attorney, he did so without Ridley.
"I'd like to stay for a while," she said as they spent another long afternoon on the porch.
He was planning a departure the following morning, and he'd assumed she was leaving, too.
"I'd like to get this house in order," she said. "Meet with the decorator and just relax for a week or so."
"Why not?" Clay thought. "Now that I own the damn place, might as well use it." He returned to D.C. by himself, and for the first time in several weeks, enjoyed the solitude of his Georgetown home. For several days, Joel Hanna had considered a solo act. Just him, all alone on one side of the table, facing a small army of lawyers and their assistants on the other side. He would present the company's survival plan. He really needed no help in doing this, since it was his brainchild. But Babcock, the attorney for their insurance company, insisted on being present. His client was on the front line for $5 million, and if he wanted to be present, then Joel couldn't stop him. "You said you had a plan," Mr. JCC began. "Let's hear it." The survival scheme was quite simple. The company was willing to admit, for purposes of this meeting only, that it had manufactured a bad batch of Portland masonry cement, and that because of this, X number of new homes in the Baltimore area would have to be rebricked. A payment fund was needed to compensate the homeowner while not choking the company to death. As simple as the plan was, it took Joel half an hour to present it. "We have estimates in the $12,000 range," he concluded. "We're not going to settle these cases for $12,000, Clay said, and every head shook on the other side. Clay didn't mention a counteroffer, and the meeting began to wind down. At $15,000 per claim, Joel knew Hanna could survive. Taking the $5 million from Babcock's client, the company could add about $2 million in cash currently on hand, funds that were earmarked for plant and equipment. A pool of $15 million was needed to cover every potential claim. The remaining $8 million could be borrowed from banks in Pittsburgh. However, this information was kept between Joel and Babcock. This was just the first meeting, not the time to play every card. The issue would boil down to how much Mr. JCC wanted for his efforts. He could broker a fair settlement, perhaps reduce his percentage, still make several million, protect his clients, allow a fine old company to survive, and call it a victory. Or he could take the hard line, and everybody would suffer. Miss Glick sounded a bit rattled over the intercom.
"There are two of them, Clay," she said, almost in a whisper. "FBI.
Those new at the mass tort game look often over their shoulders, as if what they're doing should somehow be illegal. With time, though, their hides grow so thick they think of themselves as Teflon. Clay jumped at the mere mention of the FBI, then chuckled at his own cowardice. He'd certainly done nothing wrong. They were straight from central casting. Two young, clean-cut agents whipping out badges and trying to impress anyone who might be watching. The black one was Agent Spooner, and the white one was Agent Louche. They unbuttoned their jackets at the same time as they settled into chairs in the power corner of Clay's office. "Do you know a man by the name of Martin Grace?" Spooner began. "No." "Mike Packer?" asked Louche. "No." "Nelson Martin?" "No." "Max Pace?" "Yes." "They're all the same person," Spooner said. "Any idea where he might be?" "No." "When did you see him last?"
Clay walked to his desk, grabbed a calendar, then returned to his chair. "Not sure," he said, flipping pages. "It's been several months, sometime in mid-February. Why are you interested in Max Pace?"
A quick glance between the two. Spooner continued. "This is part of an SEC investigation. Pace has a history of